We're going to open this up now for questions for the entire panel here. And just to get the ball rolling, I want to just remember that both Shlomo and now Kim have talked about the importance of patterning in the creative process. And I'm going to ask Bill Mobley and Craig McKenzie, Bill, you first, and then Craig, to comment on how patterning, as we've heard about it in the generational sense here from Shlomo and from Kim, how that can activate the nervous system and how that can foster creativity.
Well, I wish I had a brilliant answer for you, but I think we all know that patterns are important. There's a lovely book called Rhythms of the Brain, and it's the case. I mean, the nervous system is a rhythmically complex organ in which circuits fire at different frequencies, sometimes in parallel, sometimes not in parallel. One of the really cool things in brain science right now is to say, look, if I have somebody lay in a scanner, what parts of the brain seem to be active at the same time and together? There's a series of networks that actually are turned on together. They fire. They coincidentally fire, contemporaneously fire. And one of these is the so-called salience network. And another term for it is worrying about stuff you can't do much about while you're laying in the scanner. There's a salience network. There are other networks that seem to have a lot to do with issues or with the concepts of empathy and compassion. And very interestingly, those networks seem to be dysfunctional in the context of a very well-defined disorder called frontal temporal dementia, in which the earliest manifestation is a complete lack of empathy. It's as if empathy flies out the window in these poor people. You can discuss with them their condition. You can say to them, we're really sorry. You have a very big brain problem, and we simply can't solve that problem. And they say, what's for lunch? Can we go now? I mean, lunch should be fun. What do you think? I like hamburgers. What about you? This actually happens. So the answer is the rhythms of the brain are a fundamental feature of circuit biology, and we can learn a lot about brain function by listening to those patterns.
Bill, thank you, Bill. That's great. Craig, perhaps your comment here on this issue.
Yeah, I think what I would maybe the best response would be to reiterate what I mentioned before about this notion of new ideas being rooted in old ideas, and that I think when we see something that we call creative, which means it's novel and useful, that we tend to think of it as sort of coming out of nowhere. There's lots of anecdotes about, you know, stepping on the bus and then boom, the great idea is there. But as I mentioned, there may be exceptions, but the rule is certainly that you can see where these things came from, and there's a sense in which that's a pattern. So if you think about, you know, when I mentioned Edison and telegraphy and the phonograph and how there was a pattern going on there, this sort of twists on same ideas, applying same ideas. And I think in that sense, when you take a close look at something that is novel, you can see its relation to things that came before it.
Thank you, Craig. That's good. So you'll all have noticed here that with this distinguished panel, we have two colleagues from the arts and humanities in Shlomo and Kim, and we have two colleagues from the sciences with Bill and Craig. And it's great to see the interplay here between the scientists on the one hand and the arts and humanists on the other hand. Shlomo, listening to these gentlemen immediately on your right there, are there ways in which you can see that the understanding that they're developing at the scientific level can play into the issues that you're focusing on, understanding the roles of patterns in the creative process?
Well, I think definitely this is sort of turning the empirical knowledge that artists have and sensibilities into something more measurable and quantifiable. And you know, today in the digital art world, the more you delegate your creativity to a machine, you sort of have to formalize this. Now, the interesting thing is you don't need to formalize this in ways we used to do before. We can actually sort of build on these models of intelligence that the computer maybe can actually grab and grasp these principles and sort of emulate the behavior. But I find it very interesting. Actually, I have some a lot of questions that I have in my mind, so I might maybe as a response respond in a question maybe to Craig. And this is the nature of creativity in a group versus an individual. And it's interesting because as a thought experiment, if you, let's say, have a group of engineers and scientists and you come up and you write on the board a problem and you ask them to solve this problem, you would imagine that it would probably form teams of engineering or teams of problem solving and kind of more work collaboratively. In the arts, and you know, I don't want to say if this is tradition or practice, if you ask a question, you say to a group of composers, write me a piece. Each one will go to his own room and write a separate piece. Is it a different creativity? Is this the nature of the artistic activity? Or is this a notion of the persona, you know, the individual voice that affects that?
Yeah, you've touched on something that might be interesting, and an interesting difference between the arts and the sciences in general. So there is this notion of multiples. Has anybody heard of this, where, you know, Leibniz and Newton discovered calculus independently but about the same time, and you can take a look at there, you know, there's a long, but there's a long list of multiples where people independently discovered lots of things. And so there's a sense in which, and I think in the sciences as it compared to the arts, there's a, inevitability is the wrong word, but there is, you know, once you've mastered the state of the art, next steps become available, and sometimes it's a race there. So if you read Watson's The Double Helix, for example, it's a race to discover the structure. It's just, somebody's going to get there. It's just a matter of who gets there faster. And that's why you see this this concept of multiples in science. You don't see that in arts. It's not like with Shakespeare. It's not as though if Shakespeare hadn't written a particular play, somebody else would have come along immediately thereafter and done something similar. So I think that you've hit on. I don't have a great answer to your question, but I do think you've hit on an important distinction between the arts and sciences in terms of whether somebody really owns something. I think in the sciences we don't really own it. We move in the right direction and maybe are the first ones to stumble across it. But in the arts, you really tend to own it. It's yours. It's unique.
There we go. Kim, let me turn to you and ask if this wonderful set of discussions here has prompted in your mind questions of the neuroscientist gentleman immediately on your left. The question that I have for you is the role of exercise in the process of training that you go through in the third of your three sessions. That would, I would imagine, be a fairly integral part of the training process.
Yeah, I like to call them practices more than exercise, because even though we are training all parts of the mind, hopefully, to be equally athletic, I think that the training is embodied because Einstein, I think, said, everybody always has to quote Einstein, right, when they're doing these things, and an artist does, because it makes me feel like I know about science. But anyway, I think he said that nothing happens until something moves. So what that means to me is that there is movement, that the movement in the body changes what happens in the mind, and perhaps vice versa. Also, Damasio talks about how emotion is a movement. Emotion is actually a movement, meaning that you have a neurophysiological response to a stimulus from the outside, and that response makes movement in your body. So when we do movement in the class, what we are attempting to do is train these 10 facets of the creative mind by using movement of the whole body. Now, sometimes that just may be the eyes. I have a whole sequence of eye work in terms of connecting to awareness and focus, and also the spheres of awareness that go from, right, you know, microscopic to infinite awareness. So it could be different parts of the body. It could be that we are moving in a grid and learning to deal with the catalysts that come along the way in terms of receiving and transforming. It may be that just the event of moving in a circle is a lot for a group of people. Do you know what I mean? So we work on emotional presence also, but that's farther in the work of it.
Thank you. I think probably this is time to wrap our particular workshop here, and I'll turn this back over to Sandy.
Thank you. I have one final question for the panelist, which is, one of the goals of this workshop is to really explore some of the resources or opportunities that we might create here at UCSD to further work in this field. And we have quite a range of professionals here. And I just wondered if you could make some comments on types of things that for this area of investigation might be useful to really catapult UC San Diego even further into the forefront of this type of knowledge and understanding. Looks like Bill wants to start.
Can I just make one? I think there's one theme that runs through the four presentations, and that is that there's a world of value to be gained by listening carefully, by processing what someone or some piece of information has told you, and about responding in a way that allows for the other to respond back to you. So this information transfer of one to another. And so I wanted to comment, the 10,000 hours to get good at something, well, it turns out it's not really true. There was an experiment done by a guy named Birnbaumer. And you know that monks are like 40,000 hours and they finally become somewhat more compassionate, or they can go to a compassionate state and really be able to really deal with others' pain. So this guy put people in the scanner, and he asked them to make their anterior insula more active. And didn't tell them how, just do it. And then he presented a series of faces, and he did that four times, and it took 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, those people that were able to see their own brain image and were able to increase the activity in their insula were measurably more effective, more emotive, more valence positive in the presence of sad faces. Now, this is a tiny experiment, but it's very cool. My guess is that you're doing something in your class to train their brain.
Hello. Ooh. I want to be the theater part of your list of people you're working with, because that wasn't in there. Theater.
Sorry.
That's okay. You didn't know me yet.
It's done.
And we've talked before about working like in the management universe. What I want to say is that I feel more excited about this work than anything I've ever done in my life, and I've done some really cool plays in, you know, New York, et cetera, et cetera. I find that the work that we are doing is not only important for every human being, but it's also important in terms of a bridge to connect the sciences with the arts, and so that we understand that we are actually not as different as we think, and we're after the same thing.
About ideas, things that might be able to help promote research in this area?
So just one quick comment with respect to this increasing creativity notion that I was talking about. I think that there's two ways to take that. One is the theoretical aspect, and somebody asked me about experiments I'm doing, and I said I haven't been doing experiments on this topic. Obviously, experiments could be done. Experiments have been done in this area, but there's a lot more work to be doing at the individual group and organizational level, and that would involve potentially cognitive psychologists, social psychologists, organizational theorists, and so there's lots of empirical work that could be done to cement up, shore up that area, I think. And then the other aspect is a little bit more applied with these ideas that we are learning about, you know, to the extent that you can bottle this stuff up, that we need to be sharing it with maybe the rest of the university about how to, you know, maybe increase collaboration and why that's a good thing. I mean, I know that's a discussion now, but maybe we could be a little bit more concrete about it and actively manage it a little bit better, perhaps.
Thank you. Thank you. Shlomo, would you like care to share anything?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, it's a question. Tend to answer or answer the questions with other questions. I mean, it's sort of a cultural tradition. I think there is an interesting aspect of the scientific method versus the artistic method, which we touched about, and I think this is maybe also a call to address this issue, because in some sense art tends to deal with sort of a larger scale problems, which are very hard to define metrics for. Mm-hmm. And when we tend to do experiments in the sciences, you know, and in, you know, a cognitive musicologist, you know, they create these very artificial stimuli that can predict something. But when you listen to a piece of music, when you attend a theatrical show, you go to a film or read a book, it's this overall experience that actually changes it. And I think there is a fundamental quest and need for somehow addressing these issues. And especially when you're doing generative stuff, also in the arts, it's very hard to write that experimental section because you don't have measures for the success of your piece. And speaking about timescale also, so we have been working with machine improvisation systems, basically computers that create music for you. And then there was this idea of a Turing test that came up in the previous session. We actually ran a computer, a Turing test on one of our systems, comparing between two humans and machine that learned their style, improvising their style. And what we found out is that, you know, we were actually successful with the Turing test. Actually, we passed the Turing test up to 40 seconds. And then the humans could tell that this machine had no intent. So we actually can capture the patterns, we can emulate them, we can pretend to be human to some extent, but then there is something else about the human experience, which is a larger scale, which is really about what are you trying to say? And this is almost not measurable, and I think this is really essential. So it's more of a call, how would you do this?
To say, which is that the Mayans believed that the world was made of movement and measure. And I think it is also up to us to extend and expand the idea of what measurement is and what it means to measure something, so that we can include the idea that an autistic woman who is weeping and suddenly giving out Kleenex and hugging somebody, to me, that is a measure of the effectiveness. And so how can we incorporate that in a way that makes, that has, you know, that's not just, you know, that.
Very good. I want to thank you all for wonderful presentations, and also Nick for a marvelous moderation.